You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, all things considered.
I feel exactly the same way. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, well-known writer and thinker, a philosopher. You got your PhD in philosophy at Princeton, in fact. And I think you wrote a novel not based on your experience there, but a novel that probably started taking shape there, that was called The Mind-Body Problem. And I believe as far back as that, you were thinking and writing a little bit about the subject of the current book. Is that right? The book we're going to talk about, or do I have that wrong?
You've got basically right. I hadn't thought about the topic about which we'll be talking until I wrote the novel, and then I sold it, and the editor in our first face-to-face meeting said to me, "I don't understand your main protagonist. She's she's got lots of gifts. She's bright. She's beautiful. She's very sexually attractive," which of course gets the plot going. But she's always on the cusp of despair. She's so miserable. What's with her? Mm-hmm. What is it? And I thought about it because it just, I realized I'd heard the novel. I had never planned to write a novel, but I heard this first sentence, "I'm often asked what it's like to be married to a genius," and I knew it was the first line of a novel. And you could just hear the complaint in that first line. And she is. Mm-hmm. She's like a discontented person. I thought and thought about it. And then, I realized she doesn't feel like she matters in the way that most matters to her. And that was when I first began to think about this whole mattering. This whole mattering business. And it was sort of in collaboration with her, because I wasn't doing that kind of philosophy. But in thinking it out and thinking it out with this character who was not me, but I had a lot of access to her, we collaboratively came up with the idea of the mattering map. And it was, for me, one of my most useful ideas, Mm-hmm. And so it was always playing around in my back of my mind. And then it became much more than that. It grew into a whole theory.
Okay. So you've written a number of books since then. We've talked about some of them on this podcast. I think the most recent discussion was about your book on Spinoza. There was a novel we talked about, but I don't think it was.
No, I think we did. I think it was 36 Arguments for the Existence of God.
Is that more recent than
Spinoza? Yeah. And then after that, I had Plato at the Googleplex.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this is called The Mattering Instinct, and it's one of those things that people tend not to think about, but then once you bring it up, they realize that it's central to their existence. And the subtitle is How Our Deepest Longing Drives Us and Divides Us. And I would say, I'm going to ask you to just tell us what the mattering instinct is. I would say, I think it's not an instinct in exactly the most conventional sense of that word, but in an important sense. So with that cryptic clue, why don't you tell us what the mattering instinct is?
Yeah. A way to briefly capture it is it's our longing to matter, which is our longing to justify ourselves and all the attention that we have to give ourselves in order to pursue a coherent human life, which is a complicated thing, to try to justify all of the attention that we all have to pay to ourselves. We feel that we matter subjectively. It's automatic. It's a default. It's almost pounded into our very identity. But we can step outside of ourselves and ask, yeah, but do I really? Mm-hmm. And once you see the question, it never really goes away. Mm-hmm. I guess some of us, I've been talking to people for a long time about this, and some people think about it all the time, and every little failure sends them into existential crisis. Do I really matter? I don't matter. Mm-hmm. You know, how do I justify myself? Some people, you know, kind of bury it in what I call their mattering project and allows them to just chug along. But I think, you know, I think we're the only species who take the step outside of ourselves and ask for some sort of justification.
Yeah. And as you know, pretty much all species, you know, act as if they matter. That is to say, their whole system is organized around prioritizing their own interests. I mean, there are exceptions in the sense that sometimes altruism is built into animals, for example. Yeah. You might sacrifice for your offspring, your siblings, and so
it's
on.
It's all to get those genes replicated into the next generation, as we neo-Darwinists now explain it.
By and large, like, that is the organizing principle of life, to act as if it matters more than the the alternative forms of life. And you know, you see people acting as if they met. When you do something as simple as, well, you remember taxi cabs? You and I are both old enough to remember. I mean, they're still around. But back when the only way to catch a car was to raise your hand, like, if somebody next to you is raising their hand, you'd try to raise it higher. and implicit in that is the idea that you, in some sense, matter more than them. It's more important that you know. But that's a pretty, you know, kind of primitive sense. You know, that's the sense in which all life forms act as if they matter. But what you're saying is that we, and it's in some sense inherent in us, that members of our species want to matter in a kind of deeper sense or a larger sense.
Yeah. And, you know, and I try to explain it in terms of these very large brains that we have evolved that have this capacity for self-reflection that allows us to step outside. And then, you know, what one sees, it doesn't take too much self-reflection to see how much attention we each devote to ourselves and have to devote to ourselves. By the same laws of nature that all creatures who have attention are going to do the same thing, just as you point out. But we, you know, we ask the question, we want a reason for it, something to ground it. And that, I think, you know, it's really important because it's what makes us the value-seeking creatures that we are. We bring values into the world, good values, bad values, not necessarily good values, you know, but we seek values to somehow justify ultimately ourselves.
And don't we generally, when we're constructing, most of us can make an argument to the effect that we do matter and are mattering. And I think what you would say is if you don't believe you're mattering at all, that could lead to a true crisis. Even suicide. I mean, as you note, I think the suicide, I don't know if it's suicide hotline or whatever, but like the motto is like, you matter. Like that is the antidote to suicide. It isn't don't kill yourself. It's you matter. That's a more effective message to people. And that is itself kind of a reflection of what a crisis can be induced by the thought that you don't matter. But most of us who go around, well, when we're in a good mood, we are usually thinking we matter, right? Like when I'm thinking I don't matter, I'm really not happy. But when I am thinking that, I am thinking not just that I'm mattering in the sense of having some kind of impact, but in the sense that I'm having a positive impact in some kind of moral sense, right? Now, would you say that is close to universal? The need to think of yourself as not just having consequence, but having positive consequence?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I divide people up into different types. And as I said, I've been talking to people about it. It's become an obsession. It's my favorite thing to talk to people about. And it's real good conversation starter.
I'll bet, because they all are interested in their mattering.
Exactly. And the fact that I'm so eager to hear and keep questioning them about it, you know, makes them feel like they matter. Because so, and you know, so Yeah, I divide people up into different types. Some people, they don't really think about the moral consequence. By moral, I mean the consequences on other people, for example. That there are, you know, certainly some people I've spoken to, it's really about dominance, power.
And so, they put it that way? Because in my experience, most people who seek dominance and power have a story whereby this is for the good of the world. Some actor got into trouble for saying even Hitler didn't wake up every morning saying, I'm going to see how much evil I can do. You know, even Hitler had a story. Yeah. And that's kind of my view of the world, but it sounds like it isn't exactly your view of the way people are.
You know, we do, I don't think anybody wakes up and says, I'm evil. It only takes place in Shakespearean plays, right? Iago or Richard the second or third, one of them said, I am evil. I am evil. No, I don't think but not everybody is thinking about their mattering in terms of how much positive good they can do. I guess if you challenge them on it, they will have a story, a rationalizing story. But, you know, some people really, it really is a matter of how much good they can do. And of course, I'm interested in trying to figure out, according to my theory of mattering, what it is to do good and what it is to do bad. But but I think you're right. I mean, there are certain people I talk to, and this it's foremost. I mean, their striving is to make an ethical impact on the world. You know, for many of the artists I speak to, musicians, writers, it's to produce something of beauty, you know, ultimately, yes, to give pleasure to other people. But they're not thinking about it in sort of ethical terms. They want to bring beauty into the world. And for, you know, from, a lot of people I've spoken to, especially the millennial generation, their sense of mattering comes from wanting to be famous. That has become a huge
And they're just frank, and they're frank about it. In your experience,
about it, yeah. I mean, it takes a while. These conversations. I feel like my next book should be how to have these conversations on these very delicate subjects. You know, because there are certain techniques to sort of to get to this. I mean, one of my favorite examples. I don't remember if I wrote about it in the book, but I was waiting for a friend in a Manhattan hotel in a lobby. And this guy comes up and he's pestering me. You know, this is a lot of years ago. I was still fairly young. And he's trying to pick me up. And so I start talking to him. And it's the first time I heard this phrase. He's a pickup artist. That is his mattering project. Yeah, I don't remember if I wrote about this in the book. But, you know, he had statistics, how many women he had picked up. Like, and so he didn't really succeed with me, but we spoke for about a good 40 minutes and I was fascinated.
Yeah, there were best-selling books about this. That's where the word negging comes from, because one tactic apparently is to say something modestly negative about the woman and like what's the deal with your hair? And like, apparently that works. I've never tried it. I've been married a long time and, I got married before the pickup books came out, but that was a whole subculture that became famous about 25 years ago.
That's right, and that's about as long ago as I had this conversation 25 years ago.
I guess it's true. Well, maybe we should talk about the four basic kind of approaches to mattering that you sketch out. You divide people into, and I'm sure you would say that not everyone fits cleanly into. I was going to ask you, aren't there straddlers? And I was eventually going to ask whether I'm a straddler, but we'll hold off on that. There are four basic kind of approaches to mattering. You might say four kinds of. Well, no, I guess you wouldn't exactly say four kinds of stories we tell about ourselves. But anyway, let's start with the most dramatic, the heroic, it's heroic striving?
Strivers, yeah. So, Heroic strivers are people who have these sort of standards of excellence in mind. Mm-hmm. Could be intellectual, artistic, athletic, ethical, entrepreneurial. I mean, there are all sorts of standards, you know, that, mm-hmm. that you could have in mind. And for them to reconcile themselves with living with themselves, they need to feel, maybe not that they've approached, that they've satisfied these standards, but that they're approaching it asymptotically, you know, getting closer and closer to it. Spending my life in academia, this is basically, I mean, most of the people I know, I would mm-hmm. characterize as heroic strivers. I'm particularly interested in ethical heroic strivers, and I profile some of them in the book. One guy in particular, Baba Amte, fairly famous, somebody who set out to wipe out leprosy in his native India and then went on to mm-hmm. do other amazing things. An atheist. He disliked religion so much he wouldn't allow a priest into his home. But in some sense, a saint, you know, an mm-hmm. ethical striver. He couldn't live with himself without always wiping out suffering or trying to wipe out more and more suffering. So, I mean, it's an extraordinary person.
And there's generally a willingness to make great sacrifice in the name of an extreme case being Joan of Arc, I gather. But you don't have to sacrifice your life. But but sacrifice is part of it, such as your commitment to approaching some kind of ideal or another.
That's right. You know, and I mean, intellectual, artistic. You know, Vincent van Gogh. You know, with his suffering. You know, it's hard to be a heroic striver. Mm-hmm. I should say, you don't have to be a genius. You know, you don't have to make history. It has to be striving for you, you know, low-hanging fruit. One of my, the marathon, there was somebody who was running and the back of her shirt said, "I'm very slow. I hope there's somebody reading this behind me." You know, but that's all she wanted was to finish. And this is a way of feeling like, you know, this kind of progress satisfies the mattering instinct.
By the way, do you have a clear conception could you take almost everyone you know and put them in one of these boxes or saying you're on the border between these two? Or do you, you naturally think of people this way, I guess, huh?
Sadly,
yes. I mean, maybe you don't want to admit this. It could ruin your social life. Well, let's instead move to socializers rather than keep you on the spot. Socializers is another category, right?
Yeah. I should say that, look, we're a gregarious. We're a gregarious species, evolved mm-hmm. from other gregarious species. Do you know Richard Wrangham?
I do know Richard a little bit. I haven't, seen him. He's a primatologist. I don't know if he's still teaching.
He's retired now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At Harvard.
And I went with him to Africa to visit his chimpanzees, you know, his mm-hmm. chimpanzees that he has been following since Idi Amin days. They're in Uganda. He knows them as well as I know my children and grandchildren, mm-hmm. you know, by face and everything. It's an amazing experience. They're very human-like and they're very sociable. The mothers, the devotion to the children, the males, the alpha males, and they're very political and hierarchical. And you notice a lot of human-type qualities with them. And we're gregarious and we mm-hmm. need to have people in our lives to whom we will matter whether we deserve it or not. You mm-hmm. know? Because for me, the mattering instinct is all about trying to prove to ourselves that we're deserving of our own attention. But we all need the attention of others who are going to, you know, give it to us, whether we deserve it or not, our intimates, my family, my friends.
Yeah.
My colleagues sometimes. Anyway, so there's that. But socializers collapse these two needs that we have for our flourishing. And to them, to prove to themselves that they matter is to matter to others. It could be the people who are already in their lives. It could be, as I mentioned, to a bunch of strangers, because that's what the desire for fame is, to matter to a bunch of strangers. So these are the socializers. And again, it takes various forms. None of these are the right ways or the wrong ways, I should say. They can all go right. They can all go wrong. And what turns us one or the other has a lot to do with our temperament, our talents, our passions, our background, random circumstances. But in any case, yeah, so those are the socializers. I've found that most of the people I speak to are socializers. When I talk to them about mattering, they automatically think I'm talking about mattering to others. They apply that phrase. That's what they think I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a common thing. I think there are a lot of people who, if you said, well, what about your life? What has your life been about? What are you proud of? Let's assume for the time being they're not religious or anything. I think a lot of people would say, well, I worked hard to raise my kids and, get them an education. And I tried to be a loyal friend. And I think that's a very common first response.
Yeah.
You in your life do not naturally encounter a random sampling of human beings. I mean, you don't wind up in conversation with them, right? Like the people you naturally wind up talking to are probably unusually accomplished. I would think unusually ambitious. Maybe I'm completely guessing wrong about your milieu, but maybe you don't run into that as often. Although it sounds like you've taken pains to talk to a cross section of people. It sounds like you almost grab people on the sidewalk and start.
Yeah,
asking
if you sit
them.
Next to me on a long bus ride, sooner or later.
Yeah.
I lived in a religious community for a good part of my life. I guess you know that about me.
You were brought up Orthodox?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So I know about that, but also they were regular people. You're thrown into a community, and the women with whom I would speak would very much, their mattering was completely centered on their family, bringing up their children, their grandchildren, whatever. And that's how it is. I mean, my own family is like that. So, I don't only hobnob with the elite.
I didn't mean that in a disparaging way. My highest aspiration is a hobnob with those kinds of people. But this is as close as I've gotten this conversation. But and I guess in a way, the litmus test is like, we'll get to the other two categories quickly, but the litmus test as to which category they belong in would be like, what part of their life, if taken away, would leave them in a state of despond I know a lot of people who, if they didn't have all the friends they do things for and message them and so on. And I know people who, I mean, it's interesting. The question about, this just occurred to me, are some categories more prone to mythologizing? By which I mean, with the heroic strivers, is it more likely to be this elaborate story you've constructed in your head, you know what I mean, that may or may not? Whereas the people who are connecting with other people, they really are. They're not imagining it. There are these people they matter to, and the people, whereas a lot of accomplished people, I think tell a grand story about themselves.
Often talk of sort of transcendent values, like I'm contributing to knowledge, to justice, to beauty, these transcendent values. And even if it's just a little bit, which is what I tell myself, right? Because I am an intellectual striver. That's what I am.
Right.
Even if it's just a little bit, but still, you know, it's knowledge. And yeah. So yes, I think you're absolutely right. There's something a little more, well, that's why I call it heroic, right? Mm-hmm. There's something, yeah, self-mythologizing about it. And that's how some of us are by temperament. Yeah. And as far as the despondency, you know, I would say because all of us are, we're gregarious, you know, we need people in our mm-hmm. lives. I mean, I can be made miserable when my daughters are angry at me, right? Mm-hmm. Or when my first marriage broke up, you know, I was pretty despondent. But being a heroic striver, there are other ways to make me miserable as well. Not just in my relationships.
Multiple points of attack on your psyche.
Exactly.
And of course, for some of these people, it's heroism in a pretty conventional, straightforward sense, like they're saving the world.
Yeah.
So now you mentioned transcendence. There is separately a category known as the transcenders, not to be confused with the heroic strivers who are striving towards something. Yeah. In some sense, transcendent. But who are the transcenders? This is the third category.
Yes, the third category. And these are, so I use transcenders in the sense of being committed to some sort of transcendent presence in the universe, whether you call it God or something else, more spiritual, vague. But that there's some empirical presence, some sense responsible for the existence being the way it is, created the laws of nature without and the moral order within, and created you. Mm-hmm. And created you. You were intentionally, deliberately created with a purpose. This is a very hearty, robust sense of mattering. You know, it's mm-hmm. what the one I grew up with. I know what it feels like. I felt it until the age of about 13. It's a big sense about cosmic mattering. You know, mm-hmm. that you have a role to play in the narrative of eternity, you know, because that's where this transcendent being dwells, and he created you. So this is, and I know that, were you ever religious?
I was brought up Southern Baptist. In fact, it was in my teens that I became less and less of a Southern Baptist. There was a very strong notion of a calling.
Yeah.
And the idea that, you know, there's something you were meant to do, that God meant you to do. That's what you're going to spend your life doing, at least in a vocational sense.
Yeah.
And that, I guess that would tend to put, I don't know if that would put you in the transcenders category by itself. In other words, the fact that you think that what you are doing with your life has a transcendent seal of approval, is that enough to make you a transcender? You
know, yeah. Mm-hmm. But what you ought to be doing, whether you're doing it or not,
right,
is there out in the world. You know, mm-hmm. it's given to you. It was something that was given to you. It can be, I don't know how you experience it. I mean, for me, with Orthodox Judaism, there's so many laws. Oh, my God, there are so many laws. You know, it's so easy to feel like you have offended the Almighty. But you never doubt that you matter, that God is paying attention to you.
Right, right. No, it's a sense. I have not totally lost the sense. People can never understand this when I try to explain it to just kind of, you know, garden variety atheists and agnostics. But the sense, it's a sense of being judged morally that I haven't entirely lost. To me, it seems like the difference between thinking of your moral compass being outside of you as opposed to being inside of you. I think a lot of people just think, well, I feel it. It's inside of me.
Yeah.
But I was taught that it's actually up there.
Yeah.
Out there. Yeah. And I don't. That's still kind of the way it feels.
Me too. And you can see it.
Do you feel that way?
Yes. In the book, I'm trying very hard at the end to go to something objective, to ground the difference between good mattering projects and bad mm-hmm. mattering projects on something objective, not God, but for me. physics.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I feel yeah. it very much. Yes, yes. I don't want to feel that this is just arbitrary. I am in no sense a moral, relativist,
right?
Nihilist or anything like that. Yeah. So it's almost inconceivable to me.
Yeah.
So yeah, and now, that might have something to do with our upbringing. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. The last category, I was going to say, speaking of nihilists, but that would be unfair to our last category. But it is the category that you might imagine is the most valueless, just from the sound of it. It's competitors. It's people who just want to beat the other guy, basically.
Yeah, and I have so many good stories about this because nobody comes out and says this. But when I, for example, I was once invited to talk to this group at Harvard of heavy duty, big shots. They happen to be of a quite right wing. Orientation. You're already figuring
what
out.
What were they doing? Well, I was going to say, what were they doing at Harvard? But I can think of a couple probably.
But, and then I said something like, just starkly, do you matter? And there was such discomfort in the room. and then as we were talking, I realized they all understood mattering in this zero-sum sense. To matter meant to matter more than others, mm-hmm. and that it was a kind of, and that was really interesting, but certainly certain people, we've got some of them who are very much constantly in our minds right now because they're constantly in the news, mm-hmm. who clearly consider mattering as a zero-sum game. They're in mm-hmm. competition with other people. That's how they think of mattering. They're the winners and the losers, this sort of way. And there, too, I make a distinction between those who are individually competitive and those who, it's more group competition. They belong to a group that matters more than others. And mm-hmm. And this, it can be racial, sexual, gender, class. It can be intellectuals. I've met many philosophers who think they matter more than other people because they're philosophers or physicists or mathematicians. Yeah. So, it can be defined into, or vegetarians or vegans, So it can be, but I belong to the group that matters more than others, and I have to convert the rest.
This leads to the question of kind of straddlers, people who belong a little in both one box and the other. And I mean, maybe the way to address this is to say, there is a cynical view of human nature. Not that I am the type to indulge cynical views of human beings, but according to which some of the people in these other categories, like transcenders and heroic strivers, who sound pretty noble, are driven more than one might imagine by competition, right? I mean, it's pretty, the more I learn about the average famous artist, the more I realize, they weren't just sitting around doing their art when somebody happened to discover them. I mean, a lot of them are, they're operators in some sense or another. They're very ambitious. Doesn't mean they aren't also driven by a a transcendent connection or vision or feeling in some sense, doesn't mean that they are not striving in some sense heroically toward some ideal, but that it's a common combination, right?
Absolutely. Actually, I just watched this documentary last night about Edward Hopper because I'm here at my place in Truro and he lived just mm-hmm. a few houses down,
Really?
Yeah. And boy, he was a competitive son of a bitch, right? So, he kind of stuffed, his wife was also an artist. And in fact, she, helped him tremendously in his technique. She introduced him to watercolors, but she also, in pushing him forward, and he kind of snuffed her out. She was his competition. But, the question is, where does your existential, justification come from? I mean, competent, this guy doing better you know, may irk me and may make me feel, yeah, you know, I deserve as much as he has and all this sort of thing. But, you know, the project that's driving, that's engaging me with my life, that's mm-hmm. making me feel like to get up in the morning, is it to just beat other people or is it to do the work I feel that I was meant to do? You know, I'm sure with Edward Hopper was, you know, the latter was the mm-hmm. work that he was meant to do. And but you're right. I mean, we're not so neatly sliced up as I would prefer as a theorizer to make us. Yes. And of course, there's always, as I say, there's always the other people battering, you know, mm-hmm. no matter. I've met very, very few people. I have met few mathematicians who just don't give a damn about, they don't need other relationships there. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't matter to them. But those are really outliers.
Yeah. I've been listening to a biography of Demis Hassabis, who is the head of Google DeepMind, you know, one of the yeah. three big AI labs. And I'm thinking about him in the context of your book. I'm trying to figure out, like, you could make a case for three of the four kind of boxes. He's very yeah. clearly very competitive. He is striving pretty heroically.
Yeah,
I mean, he's subordinated so much of his life to the goal of building artificial general intelligence, as he puts it. But he's very competitive about it. It's almost there's a little bit of a transcendent element in the sense that he identifies. One reason he wants to build the AGI, I mean, he wants to do it, you know, safely, responsibly, and so on, he says, but also yeah. he wants to solve the scientific problem. And he thinks it can solve the largest scientific problem, kind of, the whole thing, right? Yeah. Like grand unified theory of everything that explains emergent properties and everything. And by the way, he mentions Spinoza as, he says it's in a sense a religious thing. It's like Spinoza's God is what he's worshiping. So you could put him in probably three of the four boxes pretty yeah. plausibly. And I don't know that I'll have a clear answer by the end of the book.
Because I want to read it now.
It came out recently. It's called The Infinity Machine by Sebastian
yeah.
Mallaby.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
It's good. It's very well done. I've got a book on AI coming out in a couple of months, and I have kind of a self-interested reason, and I'm actually learning interesting stuff about the history of the rivalry among the three, AI labs.
I mean the competitiveness. Yeah. I mean it always. Remember the famous stuff, you know, that double helix, you know, the
God.
Race, figure that out.
Watson,
right?
Watson is such a perfect example of,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Of at least two boxes. God, he was competitive.
So here's one. Again, I don't remember if I put it in the book. You know, by the time these books come out, you kind of forget what you put in them. And
I know
so many
feeling.
Stories because I've been, you know, talking to so many people. And I read tons of biographies, too. You know, for me, that's a great source of mm-hmm. Gathering data. This one person who he's an excellent biologist. In fact, he's a Nobel laureate. And somebody else, you know, I know him, and somebody else who knows him better than I, we were discussing him, and this other friend said, I'll just call him X. X was happy for 15 minutes in his entire life. Mm-hmm. And that's when he got the call from Stockholm. Mm. And then after 15 minutes, it occurred to him that other people had also gotten the call from Stockholm. That was the end of his happy. That's what I call a competitive person.
You mean he had to share his prize, or it was just the first? Yeah.
No, other people had gotten
it. He just realized there were other disciplines? Well, I could have saved him some trouble and clued him in on that in advance. But
I mean, so it's very hard to be such a competitor.
Oh, yeah.
I almost
think there's an inverse correlation between how accomplished people are and how long the gratification lasts from each achievement.
Yep.
There's a line about Hassabis to that effect. About him not resting on his laurels for long before he's looking for the next challenge.
Yeah, much better to be that woman with the T-shirt. I hope there's nobody behind me in the marathon. You know.
Yeah, yeah. It's there was a book once called "How to Want What You Have."
We're so different by temperament. You know, I really dislike books that say, here's how to be happy. Here's how to find your purpose.
Yeah.
Here's that. I'm so in revolt against that. We're temperamentally different. We're different by our passions and our interests and our temperament, our culture, our, you know, everything. So what does it for one person? It's not going to do it for the other. I've always hated the phrase, the meaning of life. You know, that definite article drives me crazy.
But it sounds like you would say that a given person, it's closer to being true for a given person than it is for humankind. There's no one answer for everyone, but a lot of people have kind of one answer.
A lot of people have kind of one answer. And there is another point that I make a lot of in the book. There's the urge to universalize one's own answer. You know, that if it truly grounds my mattering, then there's something objective here. So it ought to, look at the move from is to ought, right? You know, it's doing it for me, so it ought to do it for everybody. Mm-hmm. That's what, and there is, in fact, I collect sayings of these false universalizing. I mean, of course, transcenders, it comes very naturally too, because there's only one reality, if there really is a transcendent being who's giving us our purpose. And that ought to be the purpose for all of us, whether we recognize it or not. But I find it all across the mattering map, all the, so many regions that, and I could collect these statements, you know, that the fashion editor of Vogue magazine, Diana Freeland, who said, this one really tickles me. You know, it's, you have to be well-dressed. What else would get you up in the morning and down the stairs? People who don't know how to dress are nobodies. Meaning they
really
don't
said that? Wow.
Diana Freeland.
No, I know, but she, yeah. I just said she really said that.
Like, she really said that. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. She really said that. Yeah. Yeah, but, I've heard physicists say, you know, discovering the laws of nature are, you know, what other purpose could we have in the universe? And, you know, but just, so it's not only transcenders who promiscuously universalize.
Yeah, before long, we're going to go into overtime, which will be a available to paid subscribers of Non-Zero Newsletter. I want to say a couple of things before we do that we can elaborate on in overtime. You have kind of a theory about an explanation of why why mattering matters so much to people, why it's kind of an instinct that is, not what people would necessarily expect. It's not what Richard Wrangham might expect, for example. It's not grounded so much in our specific evolutionary history, I think it's safe to say, and yet it very much in being an intelligent biological being. And it is in turn, this explanation is in turn related to your conception of how you distinguish good mattering from bad mattering, kind of, right?
Yeah.
Which is not what you might expect. It's not utilitarian. You're not saying whatever does the most good for people.
Right.
So it really is, it's a very distinctive argument you're making. And let's give them another clue. It has to do with entropy and the second law of thermodynamics. bet you didn't see that coming. So among the other things I want to do in overtime is, I'm going to since like all beings, I think I matter more than most. I'm going to ask you, if you think you know enough about me to place me in one of the four mattering boxes, don't give it away. I want to save this for overtime.
You know what? I don't know you well enough. I would like to know you.
Yeah. I mean, we've had several conversations on this platform. We've been together at a conference, a small conference, a conference where everyone got their brain scanned. That's how, wasn't it? Did you get your brain scanned as part of this conference?
No, I missed that one.
But that was part of it, right? You had the opportunity, or am I wrong?
I think I had the opportunity, yeah.
Yeah, it was great. You should have been there.
I had a scan before for Plato and the Googleplex. I had my brain scanned.
Oh, okay. So it was old hat to you.
Yeah.
Damn
interesting. Yeah.
Well, then I'm gonna ask you, I think I'll ask you to classify your husband, Steve Pinker. I think I have a guess. Don't do it now. This is the bait. Plus, you would probably prefer to do it in front of a smaller audience. I don't know. But what else? So we'll get to a bunch of stuff. But before we go into overtime, what else would you like to say about the book? Go ahead.
Let's see. I am really interested in the way that this, I'll call it an instinct. It's not strictly speaking an instinct, as I explain in the book, but it's a little more complicated, but in the way that it brings out the best and the worst in us, I guess I would want to say, the way that it divides us. I've been thinking about this for so long, talking to people. It seemed, I was very suspicious of it because it grew into this, as you say, a whole theory, starting with physics, ending with ethics. I mean, who the hell do I think I am? Spinoza? You know, I was just really suspicious of it. And also, I was brought up philosophically as an analytic philosopher. We like little manageable problems, the kind that can be analyzed in language, you know, and here's this big theory growing up. So I was very reluctant to write it, and I didn't know even how I could tackle it because it was too big. But it was during, you know, these last few years of just watching the, you know, what we call the tribalism, but it's like, you know, it's like enemy camps, like really the hostility, the lack of generosity and interpreting one another, that convinced me that I want to write this book. Because this is how I'm seeing it, you know, when I'm getting very, very upset with people politically or morally, you know, that I try to remember. It's hard to be human. One of my friends said he wants to get me a bunch of t-shirts that just say, it's hard to be human. So I really think that's true. You know, that in addition to the burdens of resisting entropy, which is what life requires, constant resistance of entropy, we have to convince ourselves that we're deserving of that. That's very, very difficult. And that's where, you know, the difficulties, the triumphs, and the tragedies and the horrors, but also the good stuff of being human come from. So I guess
maybe we'll have time to talk about that in overtime. But a lot of the idea is that some of the conflicts are over like which way of mattering matters.
Yeah.
Like my way of mattering matters more than your way of mattering matters.
Okay. Exactly. Get with the program, Bob.
Right. Yeah, I know. A little late. A little late for me. If I were you, I'd focus on somebody younger than me. Okay, so anyway, again, if you want to hear the rest of the conversation, there's a link in the show notes that will allow you to become a Non-Zero member, or you can go to nonzero.org and just see this particular post for this podcast, and you click on it, and that'll take you all the way there. Thanks everybody who has followed us so far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime. And again, the name of Rebecca's book is The Mattering Instinct, How Our Deepest Longing Divides Us and Drives Us and Divides Us.